This podcast is brought to you by AJ Products, made in Sweden for the rest of the world. Visit ajproducts.ie to see how we can make your workplace work for you.
It's Wednesday, March the 20th, and you're very welcome to the Inside Politics podcast from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan. Like Ireland, the UK is going to have a general election within the next 12 months, and like Ireland, most money is on that election taking place somewhere around the end of autumn. But unlike Ireland, barring some extraordinary event taking place, the result seems pretty much inevitable. So what is at stake in British politics this year? How's it all likely to play out? I'm delighted to be joined to discuss this by Ian Dale. Ian's an LBC broadcaster. He's a writer, a sometime historian. He's a full-time political guru, and most importantly in this case, he is a highly successful podcaster for The Many, which is the podcast that he hosts with former Labour Home Secretary Jackie Smith. He's coming to Dublin next Sunday, and we'll tell you a bit more about that later. But first, Ian, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Am I right in saying it's a foregone conclusion?
Yes. And I hate saying that because I suspect, like you, I'm a bit of an elections geek and I like a bit of uncertainty. And I've presented the last four election night shows on LBC. And of course, it's very different when you have first past the post because the counts can take all night. And I know, in a sense, with your electoral system, it does go on, but we kind of know the result very early on. Now, in our system, we don't. So when I go on air at 10 p.m., we don't have access to the exit polls. They're just like BBC and Sky and ITN. So I have to look at my TV screen, look at the graphics, and immediately offer my listeners an interpretation of the exit poll. And that is flying by the seat of your pants radio, let me tell you.
And that's fun. It gets the adrenaline going.
Absolutely does.
So there's not going to be much adrenaline this time. It's really a question of by how much Keir Starmer gets a majority.
Yeah, and that in itself is quite exciting because the kind of government he will be able to lead will be very different depending on the majority. And in a sense, it's not within his gift because if Reform UK take a lot of votes from the Conservative Party, that could mean that Keir Starmer gets a huge majority. But if the Green Party take a lot of votes off Labour, which they could do in some marginal seats, that could mean it's a much smaller majority. So there is still going to be a lot of excitement, even though I think it is quite inevitable that Labour will win it.
So where are the key places we're looking at then? Some people are comparing this. I saw an article about this today, are comparing it with 1997 and the Blair landslide. And there were a couple of things going on there, some of which are similar to right now. People are sick to the teeth of whatever, more than a decade of Conservative rule, nearly two decades in 1997 it was. But also the Tories were kind of in retreat, you know, in all parts of the country, even where Labour wasn't strong. The Lib Dems were kind of doing their bit there as well. How does that play out this time? Even if Labour gets back the red wall or most of it, you know, does much better in Scotland than it did, does it need the Tories to crumble to the Lib Dems in the South and the South West as well to have one of these extraordinary results people are talking about where they end up with not much more than 100 seats?
Well, a lot of people talking about an extraordinary result where there could be a Labour majority of up to 250. But there are lots of key differences. In 1997, the Conservatives hadn't already given up. They kind of have now. There's no fight in them. There's no political strategy. There's no hope. There's no inspiration from the leadership. Whereas John Major did not give up until the last minute. So there's that difference. Also, the economy in 1997 was actually doing rather well. It had recovered really well since Black Wednesday in 1992 when we had the stock market crash and the currency crisis. The economy is probably on the way back at the moment, but it's not bouncing back. It's sort of a rather tepid bounce, if there is such a thing as a tepid bounce. So there's going to be no feel-good factor. We had our annual budget 2 weeks ago, and the Chancellor really didn't grab the opportunity to make any headline-grabbing initiatives. And I think already people have forgotten what he did announce. So and it's too late now. Whatever they announce in the next few months, it's not really going to have an impact on the economy by the time of the election.
But isn't the purpose there, ultimately, and has been for a while, it seems to me, tell me if I'm wrong, the entire leadership of Rishi Sunak has been to stop the bleeding rather than to win the next election and to come out at the other side of the next election with a decent-sized opposition party which can refocus and rebuild itself.
But he hasn't done anything to achieve that because if you look at the opinion polls, and of course they will say, oh, we can't be guided by the polls, but they are the worst the Conservatives have ever had. They're now 20%. Now, if you think back to the last election, which Boris Johnson won with a majority of 80, they were on about 43%. If they get back to 27%, because the polls will inevitably narrow, I suppose, a bit between now and the election. But there's actually, I mean, you look at all the different policies that they're coming out with at the moment, and they're just not popular. The Rwanda policy of sending asylum seekers to Rwanda, that doesn't command public support, because people think it's just ludicrous and a complete and utter waste of money, and yet they're pursuing it. And there'll be a big parliamentary clash on that over the course of the next 2 weeks. But they haven't got public opinion on their side on that, or indeed anything else at the moment. And I say that as somebody who has voted Conservative in every single general election in my adult life. But, I mean, even I, somebody who has written books about Margaret Thatcher, I'm finding it very difficult to imagine being able to support them.
What could Sunak have done differently? I mean, isn't the fact that the Liz Truss 50 days or whatever it was kind of fatally undermined?
Let's get it right here. It's 49.
Oh, my God. Sorry. I hate to overstate it. That's a very important correction. That just fatally, you know, hold the whole enterprise below the waterline, never to recover.
Well, the problem that Sunak's got now is that he's not a politician. He's an administrator. He's a very competent administrator. But he doesn't get the politics of it all. You look at what's happened over the last 2 weeks, where they had a defection from the Conservative Party from an MP who said something that 99% of people would regard as fairly Islamophobic. And the Prime Minister and his cabinet colleagues would not mention that word in the interviews that they did. It had to be dragged out of them after about 2 days. And then they just repeated the experience with the next one that came along, with a Tory party donor, who I'm sure you've been reading all about, who said some both misogynistic and racist things. And they were quite clear to anybody with a brain that it was misogynistic and racist. Admittedly, the comments were 5 years ago, but even so, fairly horrible stuff. Calling on a black female MP to be shot. I mean, you can defend it and say, oh, well, it's just a turn of phrase, but it's a pretty nasty turn of phrase in the context that he said it. And again, they wouldn't call it racist. And it was left to the Equalities Minister, who's a black female MP, in fact, a leadership rival for Rishi Sunak, Kemi Badenoch. She rose from her sickbed to call it racist. And then everyone else did. But the damage had been done. And if you don't grab a crisis by the throat and actually make an opportunity out of a crisis in some ways to show strong leadership, well, don't be surprised if the electorate just look at you and think, well, you're weak.
But were they frozen and unable to act on those two cases because of weak leadership, or because they felt that they would lose an important part of their constituency?
What, racists, you mean?
Frankly,
well, Rishi Sunak is our first non-white prime minister. There are a third of the cabinet are not white. Now, they ought to be making quite a lot out of that. And it's a Conservative cabinet, not a Labour cabinet. It's a Conservative cabinet that is the most ethnically diverse of any cabinet in history. The Labour Party have never even had a female leader, let alone one from an ethnic minority. So they ought to be making hay with that. But instead, all the hard work and heavy lifting that David Cameron did when he was leader of the party, where he effectively detoxified the Tory brand and gave permission, in inverted commas, for non-white people to vote Conservative, all that has been eradicated over the past couple of weeks and totally needlessly. And it's because we have a Prime Minister who doesn't see the politics of it, and he's got a team around him that is incredibly inexperienced, not very politically aware. And if you haven't got some heavy lifters in your comms team, like Tony Blair had Alastair Campbell, like David Cameron had Andy Coulson and Craig Oliver, I'm afraid this sort of thing is going to happen.
These are all symptoms of a party that's been in power for too long, aren't they? Is it as simple as that, really?
On the face of it, yes. But there's no law of politics that says that you have to spend 13 or 14 years in power and then go into opposition. I mean, that tends to be the case, it has to be said. You look at Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, they had 13 years. Harold Macmillan, that government, that was 13 years back in the 50s and 60s. So, and Thatcher's government, obviously, and Major was 18 years. So in recent history, that is kind of the time when there needs to be a change in government. But it doesn't have to be that way.
No, I suppose, but I suppose something happens to parties when they're in power for a very long time. They lose touch with something. Sometimes they lose touch with, you know, some of the things that you're saying here, which is the actual understanding who the electorate are and how to appeal to them.
That is absolutely right. I remember back in 1986 when Margaret Thatcher had been in power for 7 years, and that was quite a stretch at the time. And at their party conference that year, they had this slogan, "The next moves forward." And every day they brought out a new policy, and they were quite popular policies as well. And they'd distribute a little leaflet to all of the delegates, so they knew what this new policy was. And it really revived the party's fortunes, because it had only been not that long since Thatcher had gone through the Westland crisis, and everyone thought she was finished. And yet, a few months later, here she is at a party conference bestriding the political world again. She'd grabbed back the political initiative. And for some reason, each of our last four prime ministers, what a thing it is to even say that, has been unable to do that.
The other part of this that strikes me from the point of view of the Conservative Party, if they manage not to get completely destroyed at the next election, there is a way back, because in the UK and here in Ireland, I think in a lot of other countries as well, electorates have become much more volatile.
Yeah.
They bounce from one thing to another much more. I mean, I can recall only less than 5 years ago in 2019, people said that it would be a two-election recovery process for Labour to recover from the beating that they got from Boris Johnson. Well, nobody's saying that now. And presumably the same will be true in reverse in 3 or 4 years' time, especially since Keir Starmer, when he does go into power, unlike Tony Blair, he's taken over a country that's not in great economic shape.
That is true. And Keir Starmer is no Tony Blair. He hasn't got the charisma. He hasn't got the buy-in from the electorate that Tony Blair had. Nobody really understands what Keir Starmer stands for. And there ought to be an open goal for the Conservatives here, because they keep saying they're going to rescue all the public services, but, oh no, we're not going to spend any more money. And the electorate sort of look at that rather quizzically and think, well, OK, well, how are we going to judge you then? Because if you're not going to spend any more money, OK, it's about reforming structures as well. We get that. But it will take money to reform social care. It will take money to get the police back where they need to be. And so the electorate haven't signed a deal with Keir Starmer yet. So it's really, it's voting for the lesser of two evils. I think that's what a lot of people think. And essentially, we could be heading for an incredibly low turnout, because if people think they know what the result is going to be anyway, and it's pouring down with rain on a Thursday, because all our elections are on Thursdays, I mean, there's not really an incentive to go and get wet and vote, is there? So I think we could be seeing another 2001 where everybody knew that Tony Blair was going to be re-elected. And the turnout there, I think it was something like 59%, which is terrible for a general election.
Does that have an effect on party share, or does that just get evenly distributed across the board?
Nobody really knows. I think that in 2001, it was probably fairly even. I think this time, well, that's Labour's worry, and that everyone takes it for granted they're going to win, and therefore their own supporters don't even bother to turn out and vote. And that could have, I don't think it'll have an impact on the actual result as to whether Labour win, but it could have an impact on the size of the majority.
There's, I mean, there's two ways of looking at that Keir Starmer question you mentioned. It seems to be one is that he's an empty vessel, and not a lot will happen when the government changes. The other one is that he's ruthlessly intent on getting power, and then, you know, and he's pursuing a strategy which is not unfamiliar for if you're a leader in an election, if you're looking to take over from an incumbent, make no promises and arrive with an open book on your first day in power.
But you have to have an idea of what you want to do. Tony Blair says his lasting regret is that he didn't really use his first 4 years when he had that massive majority. He could have done anything, frankly, and the electorate would have gone along with it. That's a really powerful position for a politician to be in. And most prime ministers or presidents under proportional representation voting systems never have that opportunity. Well, Tony Blair did have it. Margaret Thatcher, when she was first elected, she had a much smaller majority, but then got a massive one in 1983 and led a really reforming government between 83 and 1990. And I think Keir Starmer needs to learn from that. They need to be able to hit the ground running and have a first 100-day strategy. And I think they will have a lot of goodwill, because people want... they want competent government. And even though Rishi Sunak is, I would say, a competent administrator, he doesn't lead what people see as a competent government.
And what are the things that need to be done? I mean, I'm listening to you there, and some of it sounds a little bit like something I heard a couple of months back when we had Peter Foster of the Financial Times on, and he, you know, was a very close observer, very critical observer of the Brexit process. And he published a book a few months ago on this subject, just talking about how what Britain needs to do from his perspective to fix the relationship with Europe and how central that is to what happens now. Now, you voted Leave, I think.
I did. I did, yes. I've had many battles with Peter Foster over the airwaves over the years.
So what do you think of that kind of analysis, that there are kind of, that there's still damage to be repaired in the post-Brexit situation?
It's interesting because Brexit is an issue that doesn't really bark in this election. It did in the last one because it was the Get Brexit Done election, and that's why Boris Johnson, well, not just the reason, but one of the reasons why he got a big majority. It's not really on the agenda here. And depending on where you come from, you're going to look at it through a different prism. I think it's difficult to argue that Brexit has been the disaster that people like Peter Foster predicted it would be. You have economic surveys coming out saying, well, the economy is 3% a bit less big than it would have been otherwise. And I mean, who can judge? I mean, nobody will ever know the actual truth of that. But even if it is, people like me didn't vote for to leave the European Union to become richer. Most of us voted, well, I say most, I can only speak for myself. I voted to leave the European Union because I didn't want to become more integrated in Europe. I didn't want to see the United States of Europe. And I still believe in the independence of the nation state. And were there to be another referendum tomorrow, I would still vote in the same way. We have got a lot of powers back. I think the government haven't been very good in using them, it has to be said. But the theory of restoring independent government, I mean, it's not my fault if we have incompetent politicians who haven't actually used the opportunities that Brexit provided. But I don't see it as a major issue in this election. I mean, Keir Starmer says he'll want to renegotiate things. Well, I think there has to be some sort of renegotiation in 2025 anyway. And obviously, you want trade to flow as smoothly as possible. And of course, there have been difficulties. I'm not going to deny that if you leave an institution after 40 years and a lot of your laws are effectively coming from that institution, it's not going to be easy to untangle your economy from it. So I think there have been, in particular economic sectors, difficulties, bumps in the road, whatever you want to call them. And certainly I think some small businesses have just decided it's not even worth trading with Europe anymore, even though it's now on exactly the same level as it would be with any other country in the rest of the world. So I think over time, this will sort itself out. I think politically, relations with the EU are better now than they have been since we left. I think Rishi Sunak is a very different character to Boris Johnson, who I think not many European leaders trusted. But if you look at what's happened on Ukraine, I think Britain has led the way in our response to that. And we've been able to, I think, certainly in the early days of this, we were out there in a way that the other leading countries in the EU were not. Now, Germany, for example, has now thrown away 70 years of its foreign policy, and France is becoming a lot more trenchant. And I think sort of it hasn't hurt us being outside the European Union in our response to a crisis like Ukraine. But that also demonstrates that we will need to cooperate on defence matters a lot in the future. And I think that's going to be one of the issues. It ought to be one of the issues of the election campaign. It ought to be one of the issues in your election campaign, that how on earth do we defend ourselves against the Russian threat in the future? Because, and I'm certainly not somebody, I don't want to sound like a warmonger, because I'm not. But if you look at what's likely to happen over the next 10 years, the head of the army in this country said a few months ago, we are the pre-war generation and we've got to get used to that and we've got to prepare for that. And I don't think there is a single country in Europe that is prepared for that, particularly when you look at what's happening in America. And if Donald Trump wins and either withdraws from NATO or withdraws support for the Ukraine war, well, no, I mustn't call it the Ukraine war, it's the Russian war, Russian invasion of Ukraine, if he withdraws American funds for that, well, Europe's got some very, very difficult questions to answer, and Britain has to be part of that, given that we are, with France, the two leading defence powers in Europe.
What do you think, because you know Irish politics quite well, there was a UK think tank report that came out a few weeks ago that was very critical of where Ireland positions itself in all this. You know, we broke a story here in the Irish Times last year that there's a sort of a under-the-desk protocol between the Irish government and the British government stretching back for decades, that the RAF can still keep an eye on, you know, Irish airspace out into the North Atlantic. We have our Navy currently consists of one active ship, as far as I know. And, you know, some people believe that our neutral position is actually one of the most important parts of the integrity of our independence. And others, I think, would go along with exactly what you're saying there. How do you think Ireland is going to fit into that bigger picture which you just described?
Well, I would hope that there are many people in Ireland who've looked at what Finland and Sweden have done in the past few months, both long-term neutral nations who've both decided to join NATO for all the right reasons. And I think it would be a big thing for Ireland to do that, given the history of defence and these sort of issues in the Republic of Ireland. I would welcome it if there was a big national debate in Ireland about this, because, I mean, I'm sure if it came to it, obviously Britain would do whatever it needed to do to protect Ireland. But there is a threat to Ireland now. I mean, am I not right in saying that there were Russian submarines discovered off the coast of Ireland not that long ago? Well, what were they doing there? They weren't there just to sort of send fraternal greetings to the people of the Republic of Ireland. They were there trying to suss out where underground cables were, I suspect, or something like that. Well, that wasn't a friendly act. That was an aggressive act. But if a nation has been neutral, I mean, you go back to World War II, and obviously there was a huge amount of ill feeling, I think, towards Ireland because it didn't come out in support of the Allies in World War II. Well, I find it inconceivable that if there's a threat from Russia now, that Ireland would do anything but support its European partners and allies against Russian aggression.
I don't think we have time to dig into the various subtleties of the nuances of Ireland's neutrality in World War II. However, we are going to touch on Irish history, but I'm going to take a very quick break. We'll be right back after this.
This podcast is brought to you by AJ Products, creating a more friction-free office. Made in Sweden for the rest of the world. Visit ajproducts.ie to see how we can make your workplace work for you.
And you're very welcome back. Ian, you were just talking about Irish neutrality before the break there. And I think you're probably unique among British podcasters. And you've done an entire series on Irish politics. You did a series on all the Irish Taoiseach. I'm feeling a little bit inadequate. I've been running a bloody Irish politics podcast here for years and I've never done that. What on earth possessed you?
Well, that's the reason I did it, because you hadn't. I'll be completely honest. I've always had a sort of passing interest in Irish politics. And when I was in my teens and 20s, sort of it was the Hoghaigh Fitzgerald era. And I always thought Charles Hoghaigh was a complete wrong and right from the first moment I heard him open his mouth. And I thought Gareth Fitzgerald, oh, this nice sort of kindly uncle figure. Why on earth would they vote for Hoghaigh over Fitzgerald? I mean, sort of very simplistically. And I was talking to an Irish friend who I worked with, 3 or 4 years ago now, and I realised how little I knew about Irish history and Irish politics. And I started to question why this was, because, I mean, why didn't I know more about Irish history? I knew when the Easter Rising happened. Did I know about all the sort of details of it? No, I didn't. So I watched the series Rebellion on Netflix, which I expected it to be a sort of rather anti-British, to have an anti-British slant, but it didn't. I thought it was brilliant in the way that they covered all the different aspects of it. Okay, it was a drama, but I learned a huge amount from that. So then I started reading up a little bit, and then I thought, well, I didn't even know that there were only 15 Taoiseach. Didn't actually know Taoiseach was pronounced Taoiseach. I presumed it was Taoiseach or something. So I thought, okay, let me buy a book on all of the different Taoiseach. And there wasn't one. And then I thought, well, I'll buy some of the biographies. And there were hardly any. Only two of them have actually written their memoirs. Unbelievable. Mm. So I thought, well, there must be a podcast on them. And there wasn't. So I thought, sod this for a game of soldiers. I'm going to do one myself. I was slightly reluctant initially because I thought, well, what's the reaction in Ireland going to be to a British political commentator hosting a series on Irish politicians? But actually, I needn't have worried. It's actually been really positive. So I did this series. But also, I've edited books on all of the 55, well, it was 55 then, it's 57 now, British prime ministers going back to Sir Robert Walpole, 300 years. I've done the 46 American presidents. I've just done the 60 or so kings and queens of England and the British Isles. So I thought, well, it'd be really good to turn this into a book, but I couldn't find a publisher that was interested. Even Irish publishers weren't interested, which I could not believe. And then we found one. And so the book of the podcast is coming out at the end of the year. So it's 15 essays by 15 different people, all from Ireland. And I've sort of, it's like herding cats doing a book like this, because obviously sort of some have more reverence for a deadline than others, shall we say.
Yeah, academics can be bad like that.
Well, it's not, it's a mixture of academics, journalists, former politicians and historians. So it's a real mixture. But I'm really looking forward to seeing what the reaction is when it comes out at the end of October.
Whatever about the comparison between British kings and queens and Irish Taoiseach, do you notice any differences or parallels between, you know, 100 years of Irish electoral politics and 100 years of British electoral politics? I wonder, for example, do you think our electoral system makes a big difference to the way we do politics?
I mean, I'm not sure I'm particularly qualified to answer that. I've always been really sceptical of electoral systems that don't throw up clear results. And you go back right through to the 1930s, 1940s, and it's, but actually more recently, I suppose, it's always been quite difficult to cobble together a coalition government. And coalition governments aren't necessarily bad things, but they're also not necessarily good things, particularly in times of crisis. And I think sometimes the electoral system, I mean, you compare it to Israel. Now, I know it is a slightly different system there, but a lot of the issues that Israel has are down to the fact of its ridiculous electoral system, where there's like 6, 7, 8 parties involved in the government. And therefore, the whoever's the prime minister has to pander to effectively the most extreme, because the more inconclusive the election result, the more extreme people you have to bring in. And you look at what's happening in Holland or the Netherlands at the moment, where Geert Wilders' extreme right-wing party got more votes than anybody else, more seats than anybody else, but now can't form a government because nobody wants to be in coalition with Geert Wilders, understandably so in many ways. So the one thing that a first-past-the-post system has going for it is that it normally, not always, but normally produces a clear result, and a prime minister can generally govern, as long as they've got the support of their own party, for a full term of parliament. Now, there are exceptions to that over the years, but that seems to be the way it works. So even though I can see advantages from PR, and particularly maybe in local government or in a second chamber, I would never want it to replace first-past-the-post in the Westminster elections.
I suppose the counter to it is, and maybe you see this even more in the United States at the moment, people might say it about the United Kingdom as well, is that everything gets filtered into these two large parties. Everything else becomes irrelevant. And then one or other or both of those two large parties can be captured by a minority, because that can kind of happen with political parties. And so you end up with a situation like, I would say, like you have with the Republican Party in the United States at the moment.
Well, you're right on that point, and that the Conservative Party has got to be very careful that it doesn't become like the Republican Party in the United States, and there are clear and present dangers of that happening. But there's nothing to say in a first-past-the-post system. I mean, a lot of voters say, oh, well, my vote doesn't count. And I'm saying, yes, it does. It counts exactly the same as my vote. It's just that your party didn't get as many votes, so therefore they didn't win. There's nothing to stop your party getting more votes if they have the right policies that appeal to the electorate. I've never really understood that argument that my vote doesn't count.
but your vote doesn't count as much as it does in our system. When I go into the polling station, I can vote from 1 down to 17 to every single person who's standing, making sure that the one I find most abhorrent and repulsive definitely gets my 17. So I really get to vote, and that's it.
Well, we did have a referendum in 2011, I think, on the alternative vote system, where you would have 1, 2, 3. I think it was only going to be, you could only go down to 3. But they lost 70% to 30%. So there's no real appetite for electoral change in this country.
Funny you should say that, though, because it looks to me like the British system is kind of straining at the seams. And there are all these little, I mean, you mentioned reform earlier on. There's reform, there's the Lib Dems, there's the Greens, you know, there's various smaller parties in the regions, particularly obviously in the nations in Scotland and in Wales. And then there's other smaller parties in Scotland, you know, as well. So it sort of feels like these small parties are trying to burst out, but the system keeps them pressed down.
Well, the one good thing, even if you don't think first past the post is the way forward, it keeps out extremist parties. We've never had a fascist elected to the House of Commons. Now, the Germans have a system where you have to get 5% of the vote to get in the Bundestag. That hasn't really worked because the AfD are now effectively the main opposition party. But we did have two British National Party members elected to the European Parliament, guess what, under proportional representation. But it does have its unfairnesses, where Nigel Farage's old party, UKIP, given the number of votes that they got in 2010 or 2015, I mean, they should have had MPs, absolutely, I can see that, and they got absolutely none. The Liberal Democrats have always, that's why they're in favour of PR, because they get 5, 6, 7 million votes, and then maybe 20 MPs. So there are inherent unfairnesses in it. But as Churchill said about democracy, as far as I'm concerned, nobody's invented a better way yet.
Just strikes me, listening to you there, you mentioned in relation to reform, I saw a news story just before we started recording that Richard Tice, the leader of reform, claimed that any description of reform as far right was defamatory. And in fact, he could win a libel case against anybody who said, I think some BBC News report had described reform as far right. Is the phrase far-right useful in contemporary politics, whether in Britain or anywhere else?
Well, I think it is if it's used properly. I host a panel show each night on my radio show on LBC called Cross Question. We have a panel of four people. There's usually two from the left, two from the right. And a few weeks ago, somebody used that phrase far-right in relation to reform, and I pulled them up on it. And I said, you can call them right-wing, and they are right-wing. But if you say far-right, that implies that they are from the sort of extreme racist right. And I don't believe that's the case. I think you'd have great difficulty standing that up. So I think we do have to be careful over the terminology.
Language gets in the way. It hinders as much as helps, I think, a lot of the time. I mean, a lot of these phrases, whether it be woke or liberal or neoliberal or whatever, maybe we should use better language. You have your own live Irish politician on your live show on Dublin on Sunday, Pascal Donoghue, friend of the show, been in a few times here. Do you have a personal connection that you invited him along, or did you just drop him an email?
I did have a slight personal connection in that I used to run a political bookshop in Westminster called Politicos. It's still going online, but the physical shop doesn't exist anymore. And he used to buy dozens of books from us. And so I've never met him, but I sort of followed his career because I knew that he was wanted to get into the Dáil. And so when he was elected, I sort of followed his progress. And we've had the odd little DM exchange on Twitter. And so I thought, well, let's see if he'd like to do it. And he's going to be joining. It's unusual because normally we have a politician that both Jackie Smith and I know quite well. So, because this show is not your standard intellectual political discussion show. It is, we review the week's news, we have a lot of laughs, it can be a bit filthy as well. And so we normally...
Yeah, I've noticed that.
So we normally have a politician that we know will play up to that. Now, I don't know whether Pascal knows.
Oh, I don't know whether Pascal Donoghue will play with that. I'm sure he has the capability of being filthy, you know, because we all do, but I've never heard it.
Well, we had Johnny Reynolds, who is the shadow business secretary for Keir Starmer. He did our show in Liverpool a couple of years ago, and he's somebody who on the television comes across as not particularly got a brilliant sense of humour. Oh my God, he let rip in that show. I tell you, it was absolutely brilliant. So we will be encouraging Pascal to show his inner self, but we're really looking forward to it, because we got approached to do this by the Laughter Lounge, the venue. They came to see our Edinburgh show, and they said, would you like to do one in Dublin? I said, well, would we get an audience? And we have got an audience, unbelievably so, but there are still tickets left, as they say, which you can get from either go to forthemany.live or the Laughter Lounge website if you'd like to come and see us on Sunday.
You should definitely do that. A last question to you. Just somebody who, in your writing and, you know, occasionally your involvement directly in politics, you've been an early adopter of new media. Yeah. You were a blogger before it became fashionable. You got into podcasts. You know, you're a broadcaster and a podcaster and many other things too. For the Many has been going, I think, for about 6 or 7 years now,
six years,
at least.
Yeah.
So it's relatively, you know, that's relatively long for in the world of podcasts. And of course, there's a bunch of new kids on the block as
or,
well.
Or Johnny-come-latelys, as we prefer to call them.
How important does all this change in media that's happened, the decline of newspapers, the rise of different forms of newer forms of communication, how much has it transformed politics, and if it has changed politics, is it for good or ill?
Both, I suppose. I mean, social media has been brilliant for involving, or the internet in general has been brilliant in allowing people to have a voice in the democratic process. So Mrs. Miggins from 32 Acacia Avenue, 25 years ago, her involvement in the democratic process would be limited to maybe a letter once a year in her local newspaper. Or then websites came along. Then blogs came along, allowing Mrs. Miggins to have her say every half an hour if she wanted to. She might only have 50 people reading what she said, but she still had a say. And then Twitter came along, which trumped blogs in a way, because it was much more spontaneous. But Twitter is, in many ways, is a marvellous medium, but in many ways is a terrible medium too, because it allows extremists to... Well, Twitter and Facebook, and particularly Facebook... It allows extremists to understand that they're not the only fascist in the village. That on Facebook, if somebody forms a little group, sort of in a little market town in the middle of nowhere, anybody who belongs to that extreme view of whatever it is, they realise that they're not alone. That there are other people that think like them. Therefore, they can congregate. Therefore, they become louder. Therefore, they become stronger. So it has its downsides as well, and we haven't really found a way to cope with the downsides, because it allows bad people to have a much louder voice than they would otherwise have.
I mean, I agree with all of that, but what I'd say is, if you put the balance there, Mrs. Miggins gets her voice on one side and here come the jackboots on the other. I think that it's on the debit side rather than the credit.
Well, I think it's actually too early to judge that at the moment. I mean, I'm quite a regular tweeter, or used to be, but it's when you find people actually telling overt lies about you, and then you have to react, because I don't want a lie to sort of gain traction on the internet. So then you deny it and explain the truth, but it kind of gives it more, it promulgates the lie in some ways. And we've now got to a point where there is so much fakery going around, and so many misleading clips of politicians. But I got caught out the other day, I'll be quite honest. I tweeted a clip of Donald Trump warning about a bloodbath if he lost the presidential election. And I thought, what a disgraceful thing to say. That's basically an incitement to riot. Of course, what I hadn't realised was that the 2 minutes prior to that, he'd been talking about the Chinese building auto plants in Mexico and flooding the American market. And if he won, he would stop that happening by imposing massive tariffs. So he said, effectively, if we lose, there'll be a bloodbath in the car market. But of course, his political opponents just clipped that bloodbath bit and without any context at all. So once I realised what that was, I then quote tweeted and updated saying, I got this wrong, I should have checked. But it's so easy to do. So it's got to the stage now where I think, I don't think I'm going to tweet videos anymore.
I've stopped.
I can't be sure that they're what they purport to be.
Yep, Even the royal family aren't immune. But anyway, that's another story for another day. So listen, for the many, it will be at the Laughter Lounge in Dublin next Sunday. As Ian said, there's a few tickets left, selling like hotcakes, so roll up and get them while you can. Ian Dale, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for today. Our producer was Declan Conlon. We'll be back with you later in the week. Until then, thank you very much for listening.